Hello and welcome to this edition of Two Worlds, One Country, the show here on WEHC and WISE FM radio that explores the underlying causes of what divides us, especially between rural and urban, and what we can do about it. And today's show, we're thrilled to have a guest who's really focused on that issue, but with a particular lens, which is around the all-important question of climate change. So for those of listeners to the radio station, as well as our podcast listeners, I want to welcome to the show Josh Ewing. Josh is the head of the Rural Climate Partnership, which you're going to hear a good bit about. And he comes about this honestly, growing up on a farm and a ranch, I guess maybe is a more accurate description, and having been involved in environmental issues for a long time, but with a strong and slightly different focus because of his rural roots and where he is now in rural Utah. So I want to welcome to Two Worlds, One Country, Josh Ewing. Hey, Josh.
Hey, very happy to join you, Anthony.
Glad to have you. For sure. So we usually start by asking our guests to say a little bit about themselves, and I'd like you to do that as well. I know that you grew up on a ranch in Nebraska. I'm sure there was something else to your life besides that. But tell us a little bit about your upbringing, a little bit about the life on a ranch in Nebraska, and then a bit about how that kind of has colored who you are and the work you do.
Sure. I'm very passionate about rural issues, rural people and places, which are often overlooked in the bigger picture of American politics and economics. I had a complex youth. I was born and raised for my early years in very rural Western Nebraska. Till about third grade, my dad was a farmhand in a, you know, middle of nowhere farm. You know, an hour and a half to the nearest grocery store. And then my parents actually moved to Honduras, where we spent 4 or 5 years, where my parents were teaching in a bilingual Christian school. Every summer, I would come home to the family ranch, which at the time my grandfather ran, and I would fix fence and work with cattle with my grandfather and then go back to rural Honduras. Wow. And finally move back to the United States for high school and college. And when my grandfather unfortunately passed, my parents moved out to the ranch, and I helped them start a grass-fed beef operation. So between rural Honduras and rural Nebraska, my upbringing was very much in working lands and with working people. And these days, I actually live in a teeny little town in southeastern Utah. It's a 150-person town where we all volunteer. I'm a volunteer firefighter and EMT. In fact, was on a fire call just this morning.
Wow.
And I worked for the last decade before I started with the Rural Climate Partnership, working with tribes on land conservation in the Bears Ears National Monument, and trying to find ways to ensure that these incredibly rich cultural lands are protected and used for everyone in the future and protected. So I'm very passionate about these issues, whether it's rural Nebraska or rural Utah. And now I get the opportunity to work every day trying to help folks see the benefits of the clean energy and regenerative agriculture transitions.
Yeah. That's a really interesting upbringing, a very rich one. I got to ask you about the fence building you did. My first farming jobs was the summers that I was 14 and 15. It's a little cattle farm in Western Maryland. And basically 8 hours a day, we put in fence. And back then, I'm a bit older than you, it was locust posts and then boards. And the farmer used to say, you can't be a farmer without a PhD, which stood for post hole digger. So he would auger out those post holes, and me and sometimes one other person would use that 10-pound pounding bar to set them in place. And I thought, man, oh man, this is some real work. What kind of fence did y'all put up on your grandfather's farm?
Well, I was my grandfather's PhD, and we did it by hand, you know, the old fashioned way.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You stick the two poles in the ground, you push them apart, and you pull them out, and your shoulders are crazy sore.
Yep.
And we mostly did barbed wire fence. We have a lot of cedar trees on the ranch, and so we use a lot of cedar posts in addition to some metal posts. And it's actually interesting, an aside that relates to the conversation is my family's ranch was actually destroyed in a wildfire last summer. largest wildfire that anybody can remember in Western Nebraska, 15,000 acres.
Oh my goodness.
And, you know, my parents' home that my grandfather built burned to the ground, and, all of our fences did too. So we've got a lot of fence rebuilding to do over the next years. Fortunately, there's actually some federal disaster funding from the USDA, the US Department of Agriculture, that's going to help fund rebuilding some of our fences. So we won't have to do it all ourselves. We can actually hire contractors. And
That's great.
Are you going to be kind of glad that I don't have to do all that fence rebuilding?
Yeah,
that's a lot. We have 7 miles of fence on the ranch.
Oh my God. I mean, even when you have a mechanical auger digging the holes, it's still a ton of work setting the posts and pounding them out. And then I've used the hand post hole digger too. Let's talk a little bit about the Rural Climate Partnership. And at some point, I hope, as we're talking more broadly about the divide, you might bring in a little bit your experience working on Bears Ears, because that became, at least for people a few steps removed and just watching it in the media, something of a flashpoint between environmentalists trying to tell Western landowners what to do and trying to lock up land away from private ownership. It just seemed to be kind of the worst of our often less than productive public debate. So I'd love to get your perspective. But let's pause for a moment on that and just tell me about Rural Climate Partnership, beginning with why it was created and what the basic hopes and goals are.
Sure. Rural Climate Partnership is a new philanthropic fund. We're a collaborative fund that raises funds to support grassroots work in rural communities to help countryside folks tap into all of the benefits that can and should flow from climate solutions. And so when we're in rural communities, we actually don't use the C word that much. We really are talking about cutting people's energy bills with clean energy and making their farms more resilient and more diversified and more profitable through regenerative agriculture practices. But our goal is really to try to make sure that rural communities aren't left out and don't opt out of all the benefits that really can and should see coming from transitioning to clean energy, transitioning to electric vehicles, transitioning to new ways of farming that are much more protective for our environment and for our climate. So that's our goal, is really to help rural communities see climate not as a threat of overregulation and going to force you to move to the city, but as an opportunity of how can we be more economically healthy and therefore enjoy living where we live, protect the places we live, and be able to do the things that we like to do long term.
Yeah, I love that phrase that you use, that so that rural communities are not left out and don't opt out. Because I think both of those things are often the case. Probably a little bit of a relationship between the two. If people feel like they've been left out of discussions and decision making and resources and power, they're probably more likely to opt out when new things come down the pike as well, because it hasn't really benefited them in the past. So I wonder if you might give us an example or two of some of the grassroots rural-based groups that Rural Climate Partnership is supporting, and maybe they're ag related, or maybe they're not all ag related, but just what are the kinds of things that the groups that you are supporting doing to engage rural people around climate?
Sure. There are a lot of really good groups and a ton of amazing work happening in rural spaces around climate. This morning I was on the phone with a grantee called Regenerate Nebraska, that is all about helping farmers and ranchers in Nebraska see how they can change their operations, reduce all the fossil fuel inputs and fertilizers and pesticides and chemicals, and have more resilient and diversified farms. It was a really interesting discussion. They're doing some amazing work that there are a lot more happening in places like Nebraska around regenerative agriculture than people might think.
Yeah.
But yet there's so much more to do. Or just down the road here in Arizona and Utah, a group called Native Renewables is helping homes on the reservation that have no electricity. Imagine in 2023, there are still all sorts of homes that don't have electricity, helping them get solar energy that will allow them to have a refrigerator and cell phone and lights at night and the things that we need to have positive economics and not be using, you know, things like polluting indoor wood burning stoves and having to have propane trucked in from three states away. That's super expensive. So there's a lot of really, really cool work happening. We're also working to help with the issue of clean energy siting in the Midwest and help fight against some of all of the bad misinformation that are misleading communities to opt out of the clean energy transition, and rather helping them see all the economic value that can come. So there is a ton of groups. We've made 24 grants so far, and certainly hopeful that as we grow, we'll be able to support more and more work in rural America that benefits local communities and our climate.
That's really exciting stuff. And when you say siting for clean energy, you're talking primarily about wind and solar, I assume, in the Midwest that you're fighting the misinformation on?
Yeah, you know, there's a trend right now where, you know, some well-funded folks that don't support clean energy, in fact, support the fossil fuel industry, are trying to get people to honestly believe some baloney about clean energy and just really opt out of that transition, opt out of all the benefits it can bring economically to rural communities. I mean, talk about family farms, right? Being able to pay the bills on a family farm is really hard, but if you can diversify by having a solar farm in addition to your cattle, in addition to, you know, growing some corn or God forbid, some vegetables that we all might actually eat, you know, that's incredible for rural prosperity. But, you know, there are some big, powerful interests at play that would much rather people be just addicted to buying their fertilizer or what have you, rather than allow people to be a little more self-reliant and diversified in their incomes.
Yeah, it's kind of exciting, having been involved in the fairly early days of the so-called local food movement myself, going back about 30 years, and organic and sustainable farming. It's interesting to see exciting to see the potential addition of renewable energy on some of those same landscapes, you know, with some of those same folks. Although there is, I mean, I think there's the misinformation resistance, and then there's the fact that sometimes in certain landscapes there are real trade-offs. I know in parts of Western New York, where I was doing a consulting gig, the prime farmland is just such excellent soil, but it's also the place that the big solar developers want to put out, you know, 200 and 300 acres of solar panels. And then it becomes more than just a misinformation thing. It becomes an actual trade-off when prime farmland is under threat from all forms of development. Solar becomes another threat in people's minds. So it's can be a tough one. So let me ask you this question about Rural Climate Partnership, the impetus for it. Basically, why do we need a rural focused group on climate change, whatever it is you're doing, whether it's giving money to grassroots groups, because there's lots of folks working on climate change. What is it about rural that is distinct that needs its own approach?
Sure. So if you're into the science around climate change and greenhouse gases that are warming our planet and causing some significant issues, you know, you can trace almost a third of all emissions directly to rural America. And so if you want to, you know, really make a dent that's going to, you know, make our planet healthier in the long term, we have to reduce those emissions in rural America. Well, that means working with rural people and working with rural economics. And, you know, just putting more heat pumps on buildings in New York City isn't going to do that, right? Not that that's a bad thing,
right?
But like, that's not going to accomplish us getting to a future that is a decarbonized future that can ensure a healthy planet. You know, we estimate that something like 1% of all climate philanthropy goes to a rural specific strategy, even though there's 30% or more of emissions in rural places. And I don't have to tell you about the political dynamics in our country, that we've got 60 senators in the United States Senate that are represented by 25% of the population and living in mostly rural places. So if we want those senators to invest in climate solutions. The people that live in their communities that they represent need to see this as an opportunity and not as a threat. And so, we really believe there needs to be rural specific strategy, rural specific messages and messaging that is used to help engage people and break through the divide, so to speak here. Like, you know, I really think there's a big opportunity for the issue of climate change to not be one of those culture war issues that continues to divide it. It can be something that lifts all boats, particularly a lot of rural communities. But in order to do that, we're going to have to think differently and communicate differently. You know, it just doesn't work for, you know, a city slicker to show up at a town council meeting in Bluff, Utah, or my hometown of Scottsbluff, Nebraska, and tell us what to do. It's right. Not going to work. And you got to have people that live there, understand it, look like the people that are making the decisions, and know how to compromise. You know, what we were talking about earlier with the trade-offs. There are trade-offs. Just saying like there aren't trade-offs, there needs to be compromises. And if you leave that to the solar developer to do the compromise, well, you know, they're going to look after their own best interests. So there have to be people working in good faith to find common ground, protect communities, bring those economic benefits there. You know, solar energy can be extractive just like coal energy is. You know, like big developer from, God forbid, you know, even Europe shows up and says, I want to build this massive solar project. And it's like, well, yeah, there's going to be some tax benefits, but most of that energy is going to get exported. Most of that economic wealth is going to get exported. How do we make it so that it actually is local benefit and local resilience that's being created?
Yeah, that's so true. And I don't know what they're doing these days, but a few years back, I was in contact with some folks from Windustry, which was a group that was promoting wind energy pretty widely and successfully, but they were doing it in such a way that they ensured most of the return, or much of the return, going back to the landowners whose land was providing the foundation for the wind turbines. And it wasn't community-owned wind exactly, but it was sort of less extractive, maybe non-extractive. So I know there's models out there. So you and I would surely agree that a very energetic, well-meaning person from Seattle, San Francisco, or New York showing up in Bluff, Iowa, or for that matter, Washington County, Virginia, generally is the dynamic that the way to start about playing on the divide, because there is a strong sense among many rural people, and I think particularly rural people who work the land, farmers, loggers, foresters, fishermen, that they're sort of fed up with people from the universities or the government or the cities coming and telling them what to do without ever asking them what to do. So I wonder what about your approach or the groups that you support, Rural Climate Partnership, how do you avoid that dynamic? Oh, here they come again, telling me what I'm doing wrong and what I've got to change. How do you instead tap into what for the vast majority of rural people is a strong stewardship and conservation ethic? How do you bring out the best?
Yeah, I think it does start with supporting local people on the ground in rural America. Like, you know, there need to be authentic people that are having success and able to talk to their neighbors in a non-confrontational way about these issues. Talk to them about the benefits they're seeing. Say, hey, you know, we've been doing this and it's been great for our bottom line, or we've been doing this other practice and it's really helping us not to have to be so reliant on these costs. We're reducing our costs. You know, the messenger is 75%. The message is only 25%. But you got to have those people that are having success, creating the bright spots and able to talk about it in a way that has rural language and rural relationships embedded. And the relationships is more important than the language, but the language is also important. So I think it's also approaching these things from a benefits frame. Like, hey, we can, you know, farmers, foresters, ranchers, they are the heroes. They are the hardworking people that give us our food and our fiber and our, you know, the things to build our houses. How do we support them? And how do we work with them to show them benefits? Like, you can tell someone what to do, but if it's not doesn't make economic sense for them, like, I got my families to feed. Right. You know, I it has to make economic sense. And it also has to make sense working on the land. And you know what? The other thing I'm fed up is like that ranchers are set in their ways and farmers are set in their ways. People like to innovate. They like to do things differently, but like they don't do it when they're like, you should be doing this. It's more like, you know, there's some cool new things happening. Let's experiment. Let's try something different. And that is very much the intuitive ingenuity that people in rural America have. But you don't tap into that by preaching. You tap in by working with people, networking, sharing success stories. So
that's
where we come at it from is, you know, instead of fighting, we're trying to sit down at the table. We're trying to walk in the fields. You know, we're trying to, you know, be in the garage or the Quonset or whatever you want to call it, where the tractors needs fixed, and have those conversations in a non-confrontational way.
And I think it starts with respecting people there, not just in at some sort of, oh, I don't know, moral intellectual plane, although it should be that, but real respect when you're trying to extend that to somebody else kind of begins with the thought that maybe they have something to teach me. Maybe I've got something to learn. I remember back many, many years ago, I read a book about rural development by a guy named Chambers. And he talked about it was in a nation in Africa, how the soil scientists had come to a community to map the soils, a very good thing. And after a couple of years of intensive work, the soil scientists came away with a framework of mapping 18 different soil types. And the local farmers were kind of amused because it turned out that they had already done a soil classification system and they had 210 different soil types in their classification. So it's, you know, especially in this time of such divide where we've come to see formally educated people as educated people. So to be educated means you have a college degree or more, and to not have that kind of education means you are uneducated, not differently educated, not educated in ways that books can't bring that to you. And so I think there's this presumption that country folks who are by and large less formally educated don't have anything to teach us. And man, what a huge mistake. I wonder if you have any stories of some of those innovations that that you've encountered in rural, of somebody who really had a very smart way of going about making for a productive landscape and also doing it in an ecological way.
You know, I think there's some really incredible work happening down in the Mojave Desert on the border of the United States and Mexico, and a lot of it happening in Mexico. And I think this example illustrates a point, which is that if you help people see the goal and what's working and allow them to adapt it and figure it out, they're going to do it in a much better way than someone from a university telling them what to do. So the idea of managed grazing, of actually using animals to benefit the land and sequester carbon in the soil, is all about how do we have animals be in one place, utilize that forage, then move on and allow that forage to grow back and capture energy in the soil and capture carbon in the soil. And so it turns out that these Mexican ranchers who don't have any formal education, when they just got taught a little bit about the concept of managed grazing, they now have grasses. It's the desert. And they now have grasses growing chest high in some of these places in the desert where they get like 6 inches of annual moisture. But they figured out how to do it. And they're even building fences out of like cactus. And they're building this like really interesting work. But you know what? It does take a little bit of connecting the science of climate change and soil health with practices that work on the ground. And something that works in Western Nebraska is going to be very different than something that works in Northern Wisconsin, which is different that might, you know, work in rural Virginia, for example. And I think that we can bring science in, but respect the people on the ground in knowing how to put it to work and how to make it happen in the ground. But it also has to be economical. You know what I mean? Like that's the big piece that we're focused on is if the economics don't work, then it's a non-starter. And so what Absolutely. We have to be prepared to do is help people leverage all these investments and tools that are coming down from the federal government, the Inflation Reduction Act and the infrastructure law, but in ways that respect their local knowledge and allow them to build something that works for their community.
Yeah, that's so well put. And, you know, we have a longstanding model where, at least to some degree, science, the latest science, was brought to bear in the context of local knowledge and experience, and that's cooperative extension. It's different in different places, different county agents and whatnot, of course, are different, but basically that's it, because they would bring the latest information from the land grant. But typically, because most often county agents are local themselves, they do it in a way that's less about do this, don't do that, and more about here's something you might want to try, and on your place, this might work better than that. It's kind of a real blend of experience and the latest science. So I think it's entirely possible. And as you say, it really puts to shame the notion that farmers and landowners, rural people, are so closed-minded. So I want to wrap up, because we've just got a couple of minutes left, with what the average listener. So I'm gonna speculate and say that the average listener to this program, and we like to say that we have 2 billion podcast listeners, so don't fact check that for me, Josh. But the average listener probably has a heightened environmental conscience, I would say. Climate change is probably pretty high on their list. What might they think about a little differently or do a little differently if what they hope to do is what you're doing, which is to make the argument about climate change a benefits argument, so that local people, especially those working the land, won't reject it, won't run away from it, but will embrace it?
Yeah, I think I'll give an example. I think that, we'll at least talk to 54 million Americans that are served their electricity by a rural electric cooperative. But if you live in a rural area that's served by an electric cooperative, you could go talk to one of your board members, which is probably one of your neighbors, and just talk to them about, hey, you know, I've been hearing like solar is getting cheaper and cheaper. And it's now the cheapest form of energy. There's all sorts of opportunities that are coming from the federal government. What if we did a locally owned solar project in our community that made us less reliant on fuels that spike in cost up and down when there's a war overseas? And what if we did it ourselves? Or you could go talk to the city council and say, or the school board that you're in, say, hey, did we know though there's a whole program to get free clean school buses that are electric school buses out into our communities? That would mean that we don't have to pay for gas ever again for that school bus to be driving around our community. You know, I think having those type of conversations where it's bringing up, here are some opportunities that we can take advantage of. It's not about climate disaster and climate grief and all these things. It's about opportunity. How could we save money? How could we make our community more resilient? And so I think getting involved in city government, county government, rural electric cooperative boards, getting involved and bringing opportunities to light is a really good approach right now. And that might be my single biggest advice for folks, is get involved and bring the opportunities forward instead of talking about what we're against all the time.
Very good. And that is our tendency on the left and in the environmental movement, is to talk about the bad stuff a lot and to do it with a sense of extraordinary urgency. And this is more of an everyday building from the bottom up strategy. So great. I hope you'll come back, Josh, because I think we've just sort of scratched the surface. You and I are still getting to know each other and have hopefully a few years of collaboration ahead of us. But I've been delighted to have you on Two Worlds, One Country. Again, my guest today, Josh Ewing, the director of the Rural Climate Partnership Program, a program of Rural Democracy Initiative. Wonderful conversation. So glad to have you, Josh.
Happy to join you anytime, Anthony.